From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why the Senate is not moving on money for health care for lower-income kids.
At this point, they seem to be holding the children's health insurance bill and health centers and as some kind of pawn in year-end negotiations. And, you know, that's just not fair.
What's behind a former UAW VP's resignation from the GM board?
General Motors just received a very short letter that said, I have resigned effective immediately. Have a nice holiday.
Eastern Michigan University administrators on their arrangement to have an outside company market online courses.
We've got the capacity to do it, so why not bring a marketing firm with that specific expertise?
An opinion from AG Bill Schuette on the Freedom of Information Act.
The law itself is vague, and the letter of the law does not set a fixed time for actually fulfilling FOIA requests.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The clock is ticking to when Congress leaves for its holiday break. And one big question, will lawmakers get around to passing an extension of federal funding for CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program that provides health care to just under 9 million children nationwide, kids whose families make too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to afford the cost of insurance. With us now, Michigan Senior Senator Debbie Stabenow. Senator, CHIP has broad bipartisan support. The House passed a bill last month to fund it for 5 years. The Senate Finance Committee, which you sit on, cleared a CHIP extension. So what is the holdup in the full Senate for renewing this funding, in your view?
Well, this is so frustrating to me because you're right. We passed a bill that I helped negotiate, bipartisan bill, 5 years worth of funding for children's health insurance. We did it in September before the deadline of when the funding stopped on the 30th, and we cannot get the leadership to give us one day on the floor of the Senate to do something that has votes, that has bipartisan support. And on top of that, our community health centers are also out of funding as of September 30th. They're really operating on fumes right now. And Senator Roy Blunt and I have a bill, bipartisan. We have 70 members of the Senate who signed a letter supporting continuation of funding. And we want to put those together, children's health insurance and community health funding, and pass it. Can't get it on the floor. Today is the 75th day since the federal funding stopped, and there's just no excuse for this.
I think most of us are kind of stunned that members of the GOP, Republican senators, cannot get their leadership to get this to the floor.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, they at this point, they seem to be holding the children's health insurance bill and health centers and as some kind of pawn in year-end negotiations. And, you know, that's just not fair to hold kids and families hostage in all of this, because families are calling my office concerned about whether they're going to be able to continue to get their child their asthma treatments or juvenile diabetes or cancer or just the normal everyday things kids need. And they're very worried that they're not going to be able to take their kids to the doctor.
Have your Republican colleagues in the Senate kind of articulated where they would like to make budget cuts to offset the cost of CHIP?
Well, this is something that we are debating right now in terms of, you know, where it would be make sense and not make sense. What the House did actually is something I wouldn't support. They were cutting other health care programs and so on. But I believe that it's going to be very easy to come to an agreement on how to proceed. They've just got to decide they want to do it.
So what do you think it will take to get an authorization renewal vote onto the floor of the Senate?
I think people need to, that the members, House and Senate, need to hear from their constituents that these are important health care programs, widely supported, and that Congress should not leave for the holidays without getting these bills done. There's no excuse not to do that.
And if nothing passes before the 22nd, before everybody goes home for the holidays, then what?
Well, then we come back in January and families in Michigan start getting notices about the My Child program, that the funding will be running out. It doesn't happen immediately because the state has a combination of funding, and so it may not actually happen till February or March when the funding ends and healthcare ends, but they're going to start getting notices in January. So Happy New Year. You know, you get a notice that your child's going to not be able to go see their doctor. And in January, we start to see the health clinics in Michigan lose their funding. 70% of their funding comes from this, and we will see health centers in Detroit in January losing their funding, up north in the west side of the state. We have 260 centers in Michigan that serve 680,000 people, including almost 13,000 of our veterans, and they will begin to lose their funding in January.
I have to shift gears here, Senator Stabenow, and ask you about today's vote by the FCC, rolling back net neutrality regulations passed by the Obama administration. Polls find most Americans oppose this. One survey done by the University of Maryland found 3 out of 4 Republicans don't support this move. We have a group of state attorneys general wrote to the FCC chair asking the vote be delayed because of evidence that thousands of comments posted in that public comment period are fake. There could be criminal activity here. Is there anything that could be done legislatively about this?
Well, it could be done. I absolutely oppose what they are doing. First of all, people should have free and open access to the internet. It's also an economic driver for us as part of certainly the new economy, communications. I absolutely oppose this. And the FCC received thousands and thousands of responses from citizens in Michigan and across the country saying they oppose this. And then on top of that, they're finding that hundreds of thousands of email responses actually came from Russian accounts. And so we're looking at the bots, these automatic responses that were set up that have had such an effect on Twitter and Facebook and so on in terms of interfering with, you know, the United States and what they've tried to do in elections and so on. Now they're trying to limit people's access to the internet, which certainly the Russians and others know is a powerful tool for individuals. It's important for our democracy. It's important for our economy. So I think it's outrageous, and people need to continue to speak out very strongly.
What might be done legislatively?
Well, you certainly could overturn it legislatively. That's something that we would have to have bipartisan support to do. So far, we've not seen the White House or Republican majority indicate they are willing to do that. But we need to keep speaking out and pushing for that to happen.
And as we speak today, there is word Republicans have reached a deal overhauling the tax code. The president says he wants to give Americans a big tax cut for the holidays, and he says people could see an effect in their paychecks by February. Have you seen the tax proposal?
No. And in fact, I sit on the conference committee that is supposed to be debating and approving this bill. We had a meeting yesterday, and we heard, because lobbyists seem to know this, but those of us on the committee don't. The Democrats have been, unfortunately, completely shut out, and there is no reason that we couldn't do bipartisan tax reform. You know, we need to do that for small businesses, farmers, middle-class families. I've been pushing for years to close tax loopholes that are taking jobs overseas. None of that is in this bill. I mean, this is same old. From what I've seen in the House and the Senate, even though I haven't seen the final bill, everything they're talking about is the same old trickle-down economics, telling people in Michigan, just wait, we're going to give big tax cuts to that top 1% and largest corporations, and then someday it'll trickle down to you. And that hasn't worked in the past. If it did, I'd support it. It's never worked. And I should mention one other thing, and that is they have said, boldly said, that workers will see at least $4,000 in wage increases from this. I have offered an amendment to put that in writing in the bill, that if people don't get at least $4,000 raises as a result of this, then the tax giveaway should stop. They won't support that. So they, you know, they're not willing to guarantee working men and women that they will see a raise out of this. And so it's hard to believe, you know, that they're serious. So it's very concerning to me. I wish they'd go back to the drawing board, let us sit down and do a bipartisan bill that's actually going to help the economy and help middle-class families.
Now, one of the concerns for this tax bill is taxing grad students on tuition as income and how that might affect people getting into the sciences in particular. Yesterday, Bloomberg reported that that may have been taken out to the possible relief of a whole lot of grad students. Do you know where this stands?
We hear rumors, and that's about it. And again, which is ridiculous. I mean, I'm the second in seniority on the Finance Committee on the Democratic side and have not been shown any information. And as you may have seen when this bill passed in the Senate, they were handwriting provisions in on the side of the bills that you couldn't even read the handwriting. And so I have never seen a process like this. It's appalling. It's anti-democratic. So what we really need to do is do what we did, frankly, on children's health insurance and health centers, and that is get people in a room and negotiate a bipartisan bill. And this, all this is going to do is explode the debt. And then here's what's going to come next, because they've already said it. They've built into their budget $1.5 trillion cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. So their bill, their tax bill, creates $1.5 trillion deficit, and it won't be long before they'll be back saying, oh my gosh, we have a deficit. We have to cut Medicare and Social Security. That's what's coming. And I think it's irresponsible.
Finally, Senator Stabenow, how do you think having a new Democrat in the Senate when Senator-elect Doug Jones eventually arrives, how might that impact what you and Democrats hope to be able to accomplish?
Well, first of all, it's wonderful to see that people in Alabama came together and said, no, we don't want someone who has been known to molest children and, you know, has been somebody with such appalling behavior would be in the Senate. I think it's really hopeful. And for me, it's a relief to see that people came together, Republicans and Democrats, to say, no, there's a line in the sand here on morality and decency. I've not met Doug Jones yet. I'm looking forward to it. People that know him say he's terrific. He's someone who's totally committed to Alabama, and so I'm sure he's going to bring an important voice to the Senate. What this will do for us is create a better opportunity. We will need two of our Republican colleagues working with us to get a majority rather than three, and that will mean hopefully that we'll be in a better spot to stop their cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, tax on Social Security, and other things that are really important to people in Michigan.
Senator Debbie Stabenow, thank you for taking time to talk with us on Stateside.
Always good to talk to you.
Much more ahead. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The whole point of the Freedom of Information Act is transparency. Reporters, researchers, politicians, concerned citizens all use it to get information from government agencies and pass that along to the public. But there have been controversies in the way governments and other public bodies respond to FOIA requests. And now a new opinion from State Attorney General Bill Schuette could well slow down the process times and the response times to FOIA requests. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick is here with us now. Sarah, first give us a summary of the AG's opinion.
All right. So Attorney General Schuette wrote this opinion basically in response to a letter from State Representative Gary Glenn requesting clarification on how the FOIA law is supposed to work. So basically, it works like this. There's a pretty set timeline baked into the law of when a public agency that gets a FOIA request can respond to that, either granting or denying the FOIA request itself. But once an agency actually grants that request, the law is a lot less clear. There's no set timeline of when they can respond, actually providing the information to the person that asked for it. So essentially, Gary Glenn said, well, can you give us a little bit more guidance here about how long these public agencies have to actually give you an answer? And Bill Schuette essentially responded saying, well, as long as they seem to be making a good faith effort, the law grants them a considerable amount of latitude. So essentially what Attorney General Schuette is saying here is that as long as a public agency has granted your FOIA request, they have more or less a pretty unlimited timeline to respond and provide you the information.
Okay, so there's no ticking clock and no set time. What's his rationale for this? Were you able to get any more details from the AG's office?
I wasn't actually able to talk to Attorney General Schuette's office in time for this interview, but the response that he sent back to State Representative Glenn is pretty clear, saying the law itself is vague and we should take it more or less at the letter of the law, and the letter of the law does not set a fixed time for actually fulfilling FOIA requests. And that also we should assume the government officials are making a good faith effort to respond to these requests. So essentially, trust your public officials to provide you with the information that you're asking for.
All right. With that in mind, Sarah, what kind of things have you FOIA'd in the past and what kind of responses did you get?
I've got one particular example here that really sticks out, a recent example. So I've been doing a series of stories about deaths and other issues at the Macomb County Jail, and I FOIA'd Macomb County asking for what I thought was some pretty basic information about a few years worth of their bookings into the jail, basically asking for, you know, what were the number of bookings and breaking them down by charge category. Were they felonies, misdemeanors, etc.? And I got a response saying, well, we don't actually compile that information in the form that you are looking for. And because it's essentially scattered and we'd have to match up different files and different sorts of things, this is information that it would be very laborious and time consuming for people to get it together. So we can actually grant your request, but it may cost you altogether $631,000. That's a pretty jaw-dropping amount. The irony being, I actually was able to dig up some of this information from Macomb County that Macomb County had actually provided itself in its annual sheriff's report in terms of the number of bookings into the jail for at least a couple of those years and the charge category. So clearly, they were already compiling this information in a very concise format. They just weren't going to give it to me when I asked through FOIA.
Wow. That is a pretty jaw-dropping amount. You know, many folks will never, ever have a need to use FOIA to obtain government information. So it doesn't feel like it affects their lives, but government transparency really does affect every person in Michigan. I mean, what stories would reporters at Michigan Radio not have been able to cover without using FOIA?
So there are actually a couple of really huge ones that come to mind right off the bat. So in the case of the Flint water crisis, which I think pretty much everyone has heard of at this point, the initial information that the city of Flint was not being entirely honest in terms of how it was measuring lead levels in its water, that it was sort of gaming the system that the state had set up to measure those lead levels, those were revealed through FOIA requests that were initially made by Mark Edwards, the professor and researcher at Virginia Tech. Also, the ACLU had made some similar requests. So Michigan Radio and Lindsay Smith in particular did some pretty great follow-up work for years now following up on that. But we never would have had that information if it wasn't for those records requests submitted through FOIA. Also, reporter Kate Wells has done a lot of great work on the Devante Sanford case. He was the teenager in Detroit who was imprisoned allegedly for a quadruple homicide. Kate was able to obtain a Michigan State Police report that threw into serious question whether or not Devante Sanford was actually guilty of those crimes. And in fact, he ended up being released from prison because of the information that was put out there through Michigan Radio and other media outlets. So some huge, particularly important examples there of the power of FOIA and what it can do in making an impact in real people's lives.
You know, given, Sarah, the FOIA landscape in Michigan is pretty sorry, what does this new opinion from Bill Schuette really do?
He's not saying, you know, public entities never have to respond to FOIA requests, or that, you know, it's not possible to go to court to obtain information if, you know, there's a considerable time lag or anything like that. But it does give some public entities who want to use the excuse, I guess, more of an excuse to sort of, and it's something they can point to say, hey, you know, let's say you've put in a FOIA request and it's taking months or perhaps over a year. You know, look, Bill Schuette says we don't have any sort of timeline where we have to comply with this. You know, as long as we're doing the best we can and we say we are, then, you know, there's really nothing you can do. So it just sort of adds more of a firewall to the already considerable firewall that's sort of being built between the public and public information in Michigan.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Just weeks after being linked with a federal grand jury probe into auto industry corruption, a retired UAW vice president has resigned his seat on the board of General Motors. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes co-reported this story with his colleague Robert Snell. Daniel, Jack Ashton was head of the UAW's GM department, and then when he retired in 2014, he became a member of the GM board. What can you tell us about this departure from the board? Was it sudden?
Sort of. I think it was sudden in the sense that, from our understanding, there was General Motors just received a very short letter that said, "I resign effective immediately. Have a nice holiday." I think some of us expected that this might be the case because General Motors, you may remember after the airbag and switches fiasco that was claimed about, I don't know, about 120 lives.
Yeah.
It was a very deadly thing. They were under essentially a monitoring situation with the Justice Department, and that any time they might get into additional trouble, potential legal trouble, they had an obligation to cooperate with the authorities. Now, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes here, but we do know, and we reported, Rob and I reported, I don't know, about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, that the federal investigation into the Joint Training Center of FCA and the UAW had now widened to look at all three joint training centers that are all located in downtown Detroit. And that, of course, includes General Motors. And within that situation, our sources had said that they had expressed some interest in what Jack Ashton had been doing, as well as his successor, Cindy Estrada, who is now the sitting VP of the GM department for the UAW.
So they basically have to be very upfront with the feds about things. But then you also reported GM has launched its own internal probe.
Right, and it's been conducted by Jones Day, which a lot of your listeners will sound familiar to them, who is the same law firm that defended the city and represented the city in its historic bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. It's a global law firm, very well-connected, and I would think that they are working this thing very diligently internally.
So, as you indicate, these issues echo these resignations and indictments over at FCA.
I think that's exactly right. We, you know, what happened in FCA was pretty egregious.
And remind us again, just to kind of refresh.
There was a vice president of labor relations named Al Iacobelli, who is accused by the feds of conspiring with the then vice president of the Chrysler department, FCA's department, General Holyfield, with essentially bilking the Joint Training Center out of about $4.5 million all total, spent on everything from a Ferrari to $37,000 Mont Blanc pens to paying off the mortgage of Holyfield's widow, Monica Morgan Holyfield. He died in 2015, and a whole host of other things. That has kind of been the tip of the spear, if you will, to kind of get in and see what else is going on here. What they're looking at is a lot of these vice presidents have their own personal foundations that typically are created once they are become vice presidents. They actually call them charities, but they're typically, as I understand it, a 501c3. And people make contributions. They could come to a golf outing that one of these vice presidents has and give him an envelope with $100 in it that is supposed to go to his charity. Well, the question is it going to the charity or is it going to some other means which is not charitable? Mm-hmm. Is it going in someone's pocket? And I think they're trying to drill down and see how systemic this thing is, if it is systemic at all. You know, it's interesting to note there was just a couple of weeks ago that the UAW had a caucus meeting of what's called the Reuther Caucus, where the leadership puts forward their slate for the next set of leadership, which will be voted on at the convention in June in Detroit. One of the people who, in theory, could have been or was still in office was Norwood Jewell, who headed the FCA department, and he announced, used that event to kind of announce, they didn't actually put it in the press release, that he would be retiring effective immediately. And he's not even serving out his term. He's been implicated in some of this, had received a $2,000 shotgun that had been bought by someone else with joint training funds monies, actually one of their credit cards. As soon as somebody blew the whistle on him, he returned the shotgun. But he did have the shotgun. So, I mean, what we're looking at here is a potential where a number of the vice presidents, both sitting and former, are implicated in some way, shape, or form in this thing. And some of this stuff may be very, very small potatoes. I think when some people read the details of some of this, it's kind of unbelievable about how small some of this stuff is. But that's not the point. The point is that these monies are for either charitable purposes or joint training funds are set aside by the companies. These are not dues monies from the membership. These are monies that are funded by the automakers that are negotiated at contract time. And instead of using them for joint training of employees and union members, They're using them to buy various goods and lavish experiences and things like that.
In a word, how ugly is all of this for the UAW and the automakers?
I think it could be uglier for the UAW. It bears repeating that the UAW has a very long history of being a, quote, clean union and kind of being the anti-Teamster. Mm-hmm. Walter Reuther, its legendary president, warned after World War II when they began to get things like pensions and health care coverage and things like they started to win those at the bargaining table. He warned, he said, listen, do not allow that those monies to be managed by union people. It's too tempting. They're not expert at it. Those monies should be managed by professionals whose job it is to do that and to be fiduciaries of that money. Depending on where this thing goes, I think that may be the situation where Walter Reuther kind of smiles down and says, basically, I told you.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
...156 years ago on this day, a husband died. And his grieving wife wore black from that very day until her own death 40 years later. That is the story of Britain's Queen Victoria and her husband, the Prince Consort Albert. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is with us. Now, that was quite a public display of grief, wasn't it?
It was. It really mirrored and presaged Princess Diana's death some 20 years ago. It was a great outpouring of grief by the British people.
And certainly the Queen. I mean, we think of her, those pictures, this kind of dour woman dressed in black. And
the widow of all widows.
The widow of all widows. So Prince Albert died in Windsor Castle 156 years ago today. What was wrong with him?
Well, this is where it gets interesting, because for decades, the thought was that he died of typhoid fever.
Yes, I've heard
that. He may well have died of typhoid fever. Doctors have sparsed the incubation time, the illness, and so on and so forth. But it does not seem unlikely. But then there was this notion, well, the prince couldn't possibly have drunk tainted water. Mm. And typhoid fever is salmonella. It's a GI infection, a gastrointestinal infection from eating food or water that is tainted with that microbe.
And of all people to not have tainted food or water, you would think the highest level of royalty in England
didn't work out so well that way. And in fact, you know, in history, Teddy Roosevelt's mother, very wealthy woman, died of typhoid fever nearly 60 odd years after Prince Albert. So sewage was not,
not well handled
and not necessarily, class did not necessarily protect you against it. So it could have been typhoid fever. He was sick for a long time, almost a month. He had a lot of GI complaints. He had fevers. And he had one of the world's experts on typhoid fever, a man named William Jenner, who diagnosed typhoid and saw the rash, the classic rose-colored rash of typhoid fever, about 8 days into his illness. Now, here's the interesting thing. When doctors are experts in a particular thing, they tend to see that particular thing all the time.
The blinders are on.
Right. Mm. You have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
You hire a typhoid expert, everything looks like typhoid.
Yeah.
Another one of his doctors, James Clark, was John Keats' doctor. We talked about him some time ago. And so he gets a bad rap for not caring well for John Keats. And frankly, he ought to get a bad rap for not caring well for Prince Albert, because both patients died.
So he doesn't have a good batting average.
Right.
And you also note in your column for PBS that a few weeks before the prince died, he kind of went into a terrible funk.
Yeah, this was really weird. So according to a biography of Queen Victoria, and this biographer was quoting Queen Victoria, she said that Prince Albert said, you know, I really don't care if I live or die. You love life. I would be fine knowing that I was going to die if my family was well cared for. I'm not clinging to life. And this was before he actually became ill. Now, this brings up why armchair diagnosticians like to think about Prince Albert having something other than typhoid fever, something more chronic.
Like what?
Well, he could have had Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or some kind of malignancy of the GI tract. His mother died of stomach cancer, for example. And he could have been ill for a long period of time. And then other people talk about the temperament of people with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. I don't subscribe to that, really. I think it's more of a physiological or pathological problem than a psychological one. But he may have been sick for a long time and not feeling well. And if you don't feel well physically, you can often not feel well mentally.
And I found it very interesting that when Dr. Jenner thought he found that pink rash that might indicate typhoid. Victoria said, don't tell him he had a horror of fever.
Yeah. Well, he did. He had a horror fever, and he was terrified, and rightly so. And typhoid was extremely common. And this is a common theme in medicine well into the 1950s and 60s in America, as well as in England and other places in the world, that the patient was not told about his or her illness because they might not be able to bear it. Now imagine not telling somebody what they had and the ethical quandary that puts the physician or the nurses or the other caregivers in that. And this was pro forma. This was the way it was done. And so you will probably know relatives. We're old enough to know relatives who may have had cancer or something else, and they were not told of that diagnosis. But here's the rub that I found in my own experience as a physician. People tend to know. When they're very ill, patients tend to know. So it's probably best to tell them the truth.
A good lesson from the death of the Prince Consort Albert 156 years ago this day. Thank you so much, Dr. Howard Markel.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Still to come, we'll look at how the last spike in white flight affected Detroit's neighborhoods. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Racial divisions are a major contributor to the decline of Detroit. White flight began after World War II and continued. There was a late spike in flight from the city after 2000. That's when the City of Detroit employees no longer had to live within city limits. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham reports for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative.
Even when Detroit was majority white, racial lines were strictly drawn.
You can't underestimate the intensity of that segregation in housing and the role that it played in dividing metropolitan Detroit by race.
Thomas Segrew is the author of the definitive book on why Detroit declined, The Origins of the Urban Crisis.
Large sections of Detroit were home to almost all African Americans, and vice versa. Large sections of the outlying neighborhoods in Detroit and the suburbs were nearly entirely white.
For years, some white firefighters and police violated a city ordinance requiring city employees to live in Detroit. Some even bragged about having a house in the suburbs while keeping a house or apartment in the city where they got their mail. The other white city employees who followed the rules often lived in neighborhoods near the city limits of Detroit, close to the suburbs. Morningside, on Detroit's east side, is one of those edge-of-the-city neighborhoods. Back in 1993, Marilyn Nash Yazbek opened a pharmacy there.
Now, when I came over, we had a lot of firemen, there were a lot of police officers, and there were a lot of teachers who were in this area, you know, in terms of jobs and everything. The homes were owned, maybe some were renting, and at some point it changed over. There was a lot of movement out of the neighborhood, so the wealth did go.
That was almost 20 years ago. Bill McGraw reported for the Free Press at the time and covered the Detroit employee residency requirement.
A significant portion of the police and fire departments lobbied for years in Lansing and fought really hard to get the legislature, which controlled this issue, to do away with residency.
80 cities across the state had residency requirements. White firefighters and police in Detroit and Flint lobbied hardest to end the practice. In December 1999, the legislature passed the Residency Act, which ended cities' abilities to require their employees to live in the city they served. Bill McGraw notes this was not the most significant exodus of people from Detroit.
People were leaving Detroit during those years for the usual reasons. They wanted what they thought would be a safer environment and better schools, for instance. And it's hard to say how much the ending of residency played a role, but it obviously contributed to the change of Detroit neighborhoods.
With many of the Detroit police officers and firefighters leaving the neighborhoods for the suburbs, a lot of their homes became rentals. But even that didn't last in some cases. A locksmith in the Morningside neighborhood told me over the years many of the owners got tired of the hassles of being landlords and simply abandoned their houses. There's been one more hit. Those city employees who retired and stayed in their old neighborhood saw their pensions cut in 2014. Jackie Grant works with her neighbors in Morningside, helping them to avoid tax foreclosures. She says those pension cuts hurt.
We were in bankruptcy, right, in the city of Detroit. And so people that were already retired lost a good portion of pension, which changed their whole financial future. That's when I think a lot of homes really began to be lost.
Detroit is working to recruit more neighborhood people into the police and firefighting ranks. If successful, and if those recruits stay in Detroit, it will still be years before the neighborhoods start seeing a difference. For the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. There is growing concern on the campus of Eastern Michigan University about the school's future. Tomorrow, EMU's two faculty unions are planning a protest over the university's decision to sign a contract with a for-profit company called Academic Partnerships, or AP. The goal of the arrangement, administrators say, is to better market EMU's online degree programs and recruit more students. But many professors are concerned this arrangement could damage EMU's reputation. Here's what Judy Kohlberg, a political science professor and head of one of EMU's faculty unions, said to us a few weeks ago.
It dilutes the quality of courses because students do not have that kind of direct contact with professors that has become the hallmark of an EMU education.
And joining us to discuss the new arrangement is EMU's point person in negotiating the deal with AP, Vice President and Chief Enrollment Officer Kevin Kuchera. And also with us is Ron Flowers. He's a professor and a department head of leadership and counseling in EMU's College of Education. Welcome both of you to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you.
So, Kevin, tell us why this agreement with Academic Partnerships, why is it good for Eastern Michigan?
On a national basis, distance learning and pursuing full degrees online is becoming really popular. When you take a look, you've got 2.5 million adults who are pursuing degrees totally online, which is approximately 19% of all degrees that are conferred in this country today are done online. And Eastern Michigan has wonderful courses online, but we haven't fully developed the marketing of those courses. And so our goal really was to draw students who never would have considered Eastern Michigan and put them into wonderful programs like Ron Flowers has in a master's in ed leadership. So it would be a win-win situation. So the student would get the advantage of a quality Eastern Michigan degree. The student really wants the flexibility that distance learning provides. And so that's what kind of brought the whole marriage together.
You're talking about this national shift. It reflects a difference in what people are looking for from universities
and
colleges?
I think so, too. And there are so many working adults these days that need to, number one, complete a bachelor's degree or they want to move forward with a master's degree as well. And you look at our own state in Michigan, we have a large percentage of working adults who have not yet achieved a bachelor's degree. Working adults no longer, Cynthia, want to come on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock and Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. Their schedules are just crazy. They've got family commitments. We have an RN to BSN program where those nurses are working strange, odd shifts. They need the flexibility that distance learning can offer. And Ron has been delivering that format for probably a decade. He recognized that early on.
So, Ron, before we get into how this affects your department, briefly tell us just who the prospective candidates would be for a master's in educational leadership degree, just so we all know who we're talking about and what the program's about.
Well, the students in our program are in the field of education. Most of them are teachers. They have bachelor's degrees and have been certified teachers. And so they're coming to us because the state requires them to be licensed, to be a building principal, to be a superintendent, to hold a central office endorsement.
What excites you, Ron, about this arrangement with Academic Partnerships? And how do you expect it to improve your master's in educational leadership program?
Well, I think what we're most interested in and what excites us the most is that it gives us an opportunity to have our program exposed to a wider audience. We get requests from all across the state because we've actually been out. We've actually done our PhD program up in Gaylord because people said we would like like access to a doctoral program, and so we went up there physically. Well, while we're up there, people are saying, gee, it'd be great if I could get a master's from Eastern Michigan, but I can't because all of our classes are delivered on ground on campus. And so I think that was sort of what led us to begin to look at and being able to get the word out, and AP provided us that opportunity while at the same time remaining true to who we are and that our classes are taught by full-time tenure track faculty. The curriculum is a curriculum that we've designed and that we've maintained its integrity. And so we thought the marriage of the two worked well for us.
Kevin, knowing that EMU has been offering numerous online courses for years, why was this arrangement with AP necessary in your view?
Well, we've been offering a lot of courses, you know, online, but only recently have we really been putting together full degree programs that could be done online. And we do have a number of them, but we're also looking for degrees that are popular in the marketplace. That's why we wanted to go to a company like Academic Partnerships, a marketing company, and they really specialize, number one, in working with public universities. Basically, they're bringing the marketing and financial capital, and we bring the academic capital to the table, so that's a good marriage. Ron and his instructors are teaching a high-quality, fully online program, a great degree program, and Academic Partnerships will spend their own money to market the program, to bring us students. And as Ron mentioned, bring us students that we never would have had in the first place. And we feel that it's a fair contract.
In the arrangement, it's a 50-50 split, correct, with AP except for the RN2?
Yeah, except for the RN2, the BSN program, that's a 53-47 split in our favor. The other thing is that many of these contracts have been signed for 10 years of duration. We said from the beginning, no, we really just want a five-year contract. We want to see how it goes, and maybe we'll learn enough that at the end of 5 years, we might say, hey, we're going to continue on, but do it on our own. The fact that we went with a five-year contract was certainly advantageous for the university because we already had spent a considerable amount of our marketing money to establish the name recognition associated with that particular program.
Does the five-year limit also keep you from having to get regent approval?
Yes, we would not need regent approval with a five-year contract. However, the regents were aware through conversations that our president had that we were going to be doing a contract of this nature.
Since, as you spell out, this is a good arrangement with Academic Partnership for the university, why wasn't this shared with all the faculty as it was being put together so they got input?
You know, I mean, I think there was a lot of sharing because, as you probably know, this took about 3.5 years to kind of pull this off. And we had various deans involved in conversations. Various deans went back and had discussion with faculty members. Ron was a faculty member administrator also who had a discussion associated with it. But the other thing, the way I view it too, is that we were hiring a marketing firm. And so we are marketing programs that already existed. And we're bringing in the marketing expertise to bring more students into our classrooms, which are courses being taught by our instructors. And we've got the capacity to do it, so why not bring a marketing firm with that specific expertise?
But the fact is the faculty union has filed a number of grievances and an unfair labor practice over this. How would you characterize the way the faculty's responded?
The faculty certainly have filed a grievance, and I'm not going to really kind of go down that road because during the grievance hearing, I think they presented a nice argument, and I think we as administration presented a nice cordial argument. And that's the beauty. It was a discussion, and the arbitrator will ultimately make a decision, you know, one way or another. Could we have done things a little bit differently at certain points in times? Perhaps. You know, one thing that I learned is that the faculty are concerned about the quality of instruction. The thing I love about this particular contract is that they have total control over the quality of instruction in the classroom. That's the beauty of it. That's outlined very specifically in the contract. So from my standpoint, it's a win-win-win because we've got working adults that want a high-quality program. Our faculty, indeed, will enjoy having more students in their classrooms. They don't have to worry about certain classes possibly being canceled due to low enrollment. And ultimately, I think from the standpoint of it's generating credit hours for us from students that never would have considered Eastern Michigan.
Ron, what is your team's perspective, the faculty on the College of Education, about this arrangement?
I can't generalize to the College of Ed. I can speak specifically to my faculty.
All right, talk about your faculty.
Leadership and Counseling. We're well aware of the fact that we prepare working professionals. We're an entirely graduate program, so all of our students are typically working professionals. So how do we best reach them? When Kevin came to me 3 years ago in the summer and said, would you be interested? And I went, we've been doing this for about 13 years now. What do you mean interested? We're there. We're fully online. We've been been online for a long time. We're really comfortable with it. We understand the criticism of online. We understand that there's some online that's been done by some providers that's not high quality. So when AP came to me and Kevin came to me and said, we've got a group of people that would like to market what you're already doing, I took it back to my faculty and said, this has been put on the table. What do you think? And they went down the list. We control who teaches. We control what we teach. We control the curriculum. And we brought those back and said, as long as these remain in place, we're good to go.
What I'd like to do now is turn to one of the main concerns the faculty union expressed regarding the arrangement with academic partnerships, and that's the use of coaches or outside instructors from a third-party company contracted by AP. Here's how Judy Kullberg, who's president of the EMU Professors Union, put her concerns to us.
These teaching assistants that are hired by Instructional Connections, teaching assistants, they are interacting with hundreds of students, maybe thousands of students. They don't have any role in designing the classes or even in their own sections. We don't even know what their qualifications are to be coaches.
Kevin, will there be people who are not directly associated with or vetted or hired by EMU that could be teaching any EMU students in these online courses?
The only people that will be teaching our students are our instructors. There are no coaches that are being utilized now. There are no coaches that will be utilized in the future. We've hired a firm to do marketing. Our faculty, and you can see it in the second page of the contract, our faculty retain control of who's teaching in the classroom. I understand people having concerns that, oh, in the future, you know, could you do this? No. We have a collective bargaining agreement with our faculty that we're going to adhere to. The thing that excites me most about the concept of working with academic partnerships, they're bringing us students to our instructors. We have capacity to take these students. That's the niche that will separate us perhaps from some of the other online degree providers who may use the coaching model. And if that's what they want to use, that's fine. But we're sticking with our instructors to do the classroom instruction.
Ron, we'll have to ask. We got a copy of AP's projections for the five-year contract for the Master's in Educational Leadership Program. And they're projecting by year five, it may have more than doubled the number of new enrollees. Are you able, with the folks you have and the hands you have, to handle that increase?
We would be able to do that. We've looked at those calculations. We've also had conversations with the provost's office and said, we understand that if we double that, there'll be a time when I'm going to ask for additional faculty lines. And are you going to do that? And they've assured me that yes, as our enrollment grows. We're searching for a new faculty in the K-12 side right now, tenure track faculty. So I feel very comfortable that there's been the commitment, and we currently have the faculty, and we also have over 250 PhD graduates who are working in leadership positions in southeastern Michigan who we do use as adjunct faculty, but they've come through our program, and they're serving as administrators, superintendents, principals in local schools, and they will teach a class for us. But we feel real comfortable because they're students of ours. We've had the opportunity to vet them. We know them. They know what our expectations are.
The other thing, too, I want to just interject is that we control that growth. So if we get to the point where Ron Flower says, you know, we've hit our maximum capacity, right, then we just simply tell academic partnerships, ramp down the marketing on that particular program. And if they're not happy doing that, then they can go out and get another school, you know, that they can market a master's in ed leadership with as well. So we're going to go with each program up to the level of capacity that we're comfortable with. Right. And that's the beauty of a relationship. It's a give and take relationship.
Will that also be true with the RN to Bachelor's of Nursing program?
Absolutely. No question about it in my mind. We can grow to a certain level and our faculty and our program coordinator will determine what that level will be. Also, too, Cynthia, I think it's important to understand that Eastern Michigan University is always going to be a brick and mortar university. For the last 5 years have been record sizes for us in terms of freshman classes. We're always going to be that brick and mortar institution, but we've also had a unique mission to serve that working adult. And 25 years ago, we used to go to regional sites and we used to set up shop at night and offer those courses. We still want to serve those working adults, but in a different way. And that's what they want, distance learning that fits their schedules.
As we were talking about a bit earlier, there have been choppy waters with faculty union, with the grievances awaiting that arbitrator's decision, the unfair labor practice. So clearly, many of the faculty, they're not real happy with this arrangement and perhaps don't trust you and others in the administration. How will you work to smooth things over so this new online partnership can be really something that's successful for everyone?
Yeah, I think it can be successful for everyone. And I'm trying to understand who actually has been hurt at this particular point in time, because We're bringing in students we never would have had. Our faculty are totally teaching the classes. We have absolutely no coaches in this model, nor do we have any intention. There is concern about the future, and that's why we still control who we hire. We can control the volume of students that we bring into the program. We haven't lowered our admission standards. We've done none of that. However, one thing that I did want to do is that in each of our microsites, the websites for the RN, the BSN, for Ron's program, as well as for the Bachelor of General Studies, we inserted a statement that said, as an online student, you can expect to take all of your classes from EMU instructors, the same instructors you would be taking courses from if you were in the classroom. So to me, that was a statement I want our faculty to understand, is that we want you doing the teaching. We think you are the niche that will set us aside from the pack. That's the message I heard from our faculty, and that's what we want to provide too.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for spending time with us and talking with us on Stateside.
Sure, it was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Kevin Kuchera is Vice President and Chief Enrollment Officer at Eastern Michigan University, and Ron Flowers is a professor and Department Head of Leadership and Counseling in EMU's College of Education. This is Stateside.